Well, hello, dear listener, and welcome to episode 69 of Making It Women in Film, a podcast where I sit down with women working across the film and TV industry to learn their story and hear all about their craft, career, and vigorous resilience. My name is Evita, and I am very excited to bring this week's episode, produced by Bonnie and Broad and Ellis Films, to you. Because today I spoke with Luis Vise, a former naval officer, yes, you heard that right, and a current documentary and drama producer with titles on a belt such as Dracula, Les Miserables, and the highly acclaimed BBC show Shetland. Hear all about how she made her wild career jump, the most challenging shoots she's organized, and all the details behind high-end drama production you never would have thought of. And if you stick around until the end, you can hear our roundtable where Lauren and I touch on the Oscar nominations and also have a very, let's just call it a free-flowing talk about the Netflix show Ginny and Georgia. But first, Louise. Enjoy.
My mum was an actress, and she was on the kind of amateur circuit in South Wales. So I was born in Bridgend near Cardiff, and I used to go round the Welsh valleys with her to various theatres and see her perform and do little critiques on her. You know, you'd have adjudicators, and she went to the Monte Carlo World Drama Festival and was in Undermilt Wood there and played some, you know, she was an amazing actress, and she really inspired me when I was little. She was also in the Navy, though, and she met my dad in the Navy, and that also inspired me. So when I graduated from university, I kind of joined the Royal Navy. That was my first career, and spent six, nearly seven happy years as a lieutenant in the Navy. And during that time, I joined the Royal Navy Dramatic Society and was in Pygmalion and started to make little films. And so when I left the Navy, I was kind of already thinking along the lines of storytelling and filmmaking.
Clearly. So it's interesting that there definitely was like a creative touch to your upbringing, you know, with your mother and that. Did you watch a lot of movies?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it was kind of a ritual in our house to sit down, bring the sofa forward towards the fire, and watch films. I mean, It's a Wonderful Life is probably our family favourite, which we watch at any time of year, not just Christmas. And I think my favourite movie as a kid was Wizard of Oz, which I still adore. It's probably still in my top five, actually. So, yeah, watch storytelling with each other as well as watching it on TV and on film was something that my family did a lot of. We like to kind of gather around the table and tell stories and stuff like that. So I think it's in my blood, really. But I mean, I didn't go straight into filmmaking when I left the Navy. I actually went to Bradford University to the Peace Studies department to do a PhD, of all things, which was one mega story. and during that time, I got involved in an amazing theatre group at Bradford, which was based at Theatre in the Mill, which was a really kind of well-known and still is a well-known fringe theatre venue in Yorkshire. And that's really where I cut my teeth in drama. I was acting, writing, directing. And when you're in an encouraging environment like that, you're not frightened to make mistakes and learn from them. But I'd like to think we didn't make too many mistakes because I had an amazing adventure with them. We went to Moscow and I was in an adaptation of Dostoevsky's Crime and Punishment. I took a play to the Fringe. I played Prospero in an adaptation of The Tempest at the Fringe. You know, all sorts of things that really opened my eyes to dramatic structure and storytelling while doing a PhD.
Yeah. But then you kind of entered into documentaries for a while, didn't you?
I did. That was a strange thing, actually, because there was a period in my life where I could have gone in either direction. I was finishing my PhD. I was assistant director on pantomime at Wakefield Theatre Royal, Aladdin. And I was also at the same time making inroads into documentaries, developing ideas and talking to people. And I went to the Sheffield International Documentary Festival, actually. And that's really what inspired me to move more into documentaries at that point, because I guess I'd learned a lot about factual research doing my PhD. But yet I wanted to be creative. I didn't want to be an academic. So I put together a few ideas for a documentary company in Leeds, near where I was living at the time, and they liked what I was developing and kind of took me on. And I ended up making a few films with them before going to Yorkshire Television and cutting my teeth on programmes for ITV like Holidays from Hell, and which did brilliantly ratings-wise. And I was doing a lot of undercover filming, learning how to use handbag cameras and shirt cameras and filming in appallingly run resorts around Europe. It was great fun. You know, I was filming, there was a resort in Portugal where we were serving sprouts for breakfast.
Lovely.
Mushy Brussels sprouts. And so, of course, our poor British tour holiday makers didn't want to eat that for breakfast. So I was out there filming mushy Brussels sprouts. But I tell you what it did teach me was how to tell a story well in a short space of time, how to film it, how to tell it, how to make it amusing, how to make it serious, how to make it moving, how to make it emotional, how to make people angry through what they watch as well. So while Holidays from Hell is a million miles from what I do now, in terms of the structure and the techniques of storytelling, it really did help me to kind of formulate the way I work and build upon that.
Yeah, definitely. I want to go a little bit back, though, because clearly, so, you know, when you were in the Navy, there was still, you know, that sprinkle of creativity. But when was it that the kind of switch flicked and you were like, this is where I need to go?
I left the Navy for a number of reasons, and I wanted to be more creative in my life. I was the only Guardian reader in the wardroom, and they used to keep a copy of the paper for me. I was a bit of a free spirit, I think. And while I really enjoyed my time in the Navy and still keep in touch with folk that I... Friendships are formed for life when you meet folk in the Navy. I wanted to... Something about my past and about the instinct to be a storyteller and about getting those stories out there was something that I really wanted to do. You know, I joined the Navy when I left university, partly, I think, because my parents had been in the Navy, partly because when I was a student, I went on an acquaint visit where the Navy wined and dined me, and I thought, well, this is good. And I was kind of taken with it, really. But it was a really good start to my career because it taught me management and leadership, how to be organised, how to inspire people. You know, the Navy really, at a very young age, gave me the blessing of a lot of maturity beyond my years, I think. I've drawn on that all my life and continue to do so in terms of the way I manage people and manage a team and lead a team. A lot of that started when I was in the Navy. And I think there's a lot of service life that is very much like filmmaking and television, the craft of it. In the Navy, you have daily orders. It tells you what you're doing that day. In drama, you have a call sheet and it tells you what you're doing that day. You have to be on time. You have to be punctual. You have to have a plan. And yes, that plan is creative, but you still got to have a plan and you've got to make your day. You've got to finish when you say you've got to finish. I mean, you don't always, and there are always good reasons if you go over on the day, but there is a lot of service life that is a bit like the life in film and television, I think.
Yeah, definitely. And then if you get into documentaries, like being on location and adjusting to those environments, definitely. Like,
it's about stamina as well.
A lot you've learned from that.
Mental and physical. You know, we made 2 seasons of Shetland last year. Season 6 and season 7 in 1 year, which is unusual and shouldn't really be done, if I'm honest. Too much. 12 hours of high-end television drama in 1 year is a tall order. But we had to do it because it was a double commission and because of COVID. So our production from 2020 was bumped into 2021, season 6. And then we also had to make season 7 within the parameters of getting all the filming done while the weather conditions in Shetland were kind enough to us to get it done, because it is pretty full on up there sometimes. We'll come on to that, I'm sure, but...
Yeah. I definitely, like, absolutely need to talk about Shetland. You said you're getting into documentary filmmaking and you're learning a lot there, and that was kind of, a lot of hands-on experience, you know. How did you get back into drama?
There were a few occasions during my documentary making career, which was about 18, 19, 20 years long. I mean, I still see myself a little bit as a documentary maker. I'm a storyteller, whether it's drama or documentary, okay? That's how I see me. And there were various moments in my documentary career when I kind of dipped my toe into drama. When I was directing films, I would make quite ambitious dramatic reconstructions. So, for instance, I made a film about the Battle of Waterloo and recreated the moment that Wellington meets Blücher, the Prussian officer, and the moment when we see Napoleon in the field, which was filmed in a field full of smoke outside Salisbury, you know, but I also filmed a charge of one of the regiments at Waterloo. So yeah, it's that was done on a budget of about £3,000 or something. And I also made a film about the Battle of Jutland. And when I was making the film about the Battle of Jutland, I used HMS Belfast in London and recreated what happened at the Battle of Jutland using a lot of smoke and a few actors, willing volunteers effectively, to recreate that and the firepower of the battleships. So I dipped my toe in then. And then in 2005, I made a film. I was associate producer on a film for ITV and Discovery that was a factual drama about the building of the Titanic. A fascinating film where I did a lot of the factual groundwork and briefed the writer and then was on set to basically keep an eye on authenticity and accuracy. The film was about a small group of men called the Guarantee Group, who were men that worked on the building of the ship. So we followed their lives as they built the ship. It was my first time I did high-end visual effects. We built a massive set in Liverpool on a slipway of the Titanic being built. The set was about 150 feet long by about 50 feet high. So there's a massive portion of the Titanic, the Arrol gantry next to it, which is the name of the gantry that was built to support the building of the ship. And then I did a lot of the green screen filming there of workers, of the propellers, of all sorts of things. And we had these three massive green screens that turned into giant kites on windy days. They were about 30 feet high and we were wheeling them around the set. So that was a fully scripted drama. That was 2005. And then I went back to other kind of documentary making shows like How the Universe Works for Discovery. I did Robson Green Extreme Fishing. I did my most recent documentary, which was the last doc that I made, was in 2017 for ITV about Ross Kemp inside a high security prison called Barlinnie in Glasgow. I dipped my toe into drama before. And then back in 2016, I was series producing a series about prisons for Sky. It was called Prison First and Last 24 Hours. And we were watching prisoners come in and leave prison across four different prisons, male and female prisoners. Fascinating. And we got a recommission. We made a second series. And while I was making that second series, one of my team said to me, oh, I've just seen this advert from Screen Skills for a high-end television producer training scheme. They knew at the time I was doing some work at the Tron Theatre in Glasgow, and it was called the Tron 100, actually. It was 100 creatives across Scotland picked to do new work. And I was really lucky to be picked for that, and I was writing a play and directing actors. And I really felt at that point that I wanted to get back to drama and have a new challenge in my career. And I applied for the scheme and got on it. Very happy days. I was punching the air, jumping up and down. I was so happy. and that really opened the door for me at quite a high level. I had a lot to learn, and I knew I had a lot to learn about the way the whole system operates, because documentaries and drama are a bit like chalk and cheese, really.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's exactly. Yeah. At the same time, I think so many great drama filmmakers come from a documentary background, and you can really see it in the way that the characters are portrayed, and because I think you really get to settle into characters and real life, you know, and understand that and observe it and know how to cut it and present it. It's where you start.
No, I absolutely agree. For me, the key thing is always about authenticity. Authenticity in that moment of that character, in their emotional story, in their narrative arc. It has to feel authentic and true for them and the context in which they're playing it. Whether it's Madame Thénardier, brilliantly played by Olivia Colman in Les Miserables, you know, or Claes Bang playing Dracula, you know, or Douglas Henshaw playing Perez in Shetland. All those performances are brilliantly played by the actors I've mentioned, and they are all authentic, both emotionally authentic and true to that moment in time, helped obviously by the design, by the location choice, by the hair and makeup, by the costume, all coming together. That's what I love about drama, is this huge combined effort to portray this story as best as we can within the budget. Of course, there's always that constraint. There's never enough money. But everybody coming together to that one goal, which is telling that story and being true to that story in the best possible way that we can. Oh, it just gives me a buzz every time.
Yeah, and I think... I mean, that's what you need, you know, that's what you're looking for. And that's when you know you're, you know, in the right line of work. I think, you know, film, as you're saying, authenticity is the most important part, because you can instantly tell when something was written by somebody who has no clue what they're talking about, or if a dialogue just feels sticky, you know. At the same time, film is manufactured, as you were saying. It's hair, it's makeup, it's the production design, it's editing, it's VFX, it's all of this. It's not real, and so it's really difficult to not get swept up in that, and so to anchor yourself to the truth in it is something you have to commit to and keep an eye on.
You absolutely have to commit to it. Chris Carey, who's a really talented exec producer, who was the producer of Les Mis, who took me under his wing, and I was co-producer with him of Les Miserables, he said to me very early on, he said, drama isn't meant to be made. It's just this huge juggernaut of everybody moving, and it's your job to make sure they're all moving in the right direction. Because everybody could pull in different directions. It could become a complete mess. Yes, you've got the script as your guide, but you also have to then practically apply that script and produce it. Hence, producer, you know. And it's that's key. And it's all about communication, having meetings, talking to folk, brainstorming. I very much come from the school of thought that initially there's no such thing as a bad idea. And in fact, not just initially, but throughout, because sometimes you have to troubleshoot. And plan A becomes plan B becomes plan C for whatever reason. Script, weather, location costs, availability of actor, whatever it might be. So you have to think on your feet a lot. I hope that answers your question.
Oh, 100%. On that note, what's the most difficult scene you've ever had to execute?
Wow, that's a question. Well, I think up there amongst them was the opening scene of Les Miserables, which is set in the aftermath of the Battle of Waterloo. So that was filmed in a field about three quarters of an hour outside Brussels. And we had to have over 200 extras. We had to have real horses, and we had to have models of horses that we would bury in the mud. We had the longest track I think I've ever seen. We had a storm in the middle of filming that flooded sections of the set. And there was thunder and lightning, and it was a real health and safety issue. We also had our actor in amongst it all. Yeah, that was huge. And there was a lot of planning, obviously, that went into that. And because I'd done a film about the Battle of Waterloo several years before, I came with my kind of nerd hat on and worked very closely with costume makeup about the look of that to make sure it was historically accurate and true in terms of costume makeup look. Even the look of battlefield injuries we got right, because I interviewed a surgeon who was an expert in Napoleonic injuries. So we got the prosthetics of that right. Yeah, very challenged, but I think the end product was something quite spectacular. And of course, there was a lot of green screen that day as well. So we do this massive pullout in the end to reveal the whole of the battlefield and then the opening titles. So that's up there. It's one of the big ones.
It sounds like, yeah. Mm. Wow. And especially it being the opening shot, you know, it's not something you can really, like, that has to be it. How long did it take to get the final shot?
Well, we filmed all of that in a day.
Wow.
A long day. We went over. We went over, really, because we had to down tools for a couple of hours because of the weather as well. And we had we had three cameras on that day, and I was out directing third camera, so we were picking up details. So we had material to cut to in the edit. In terms of the post-production, though, that was a big number.
Yeah. I want to talk about you know, VFX and green screen, because it's such an interesting topic, because especially when you're shooting it, you know, you can only imagine. Mm. And obviously you have sketchups and things like that, but you don't know what it's really going to look like and what you're going to be faced with in the editing room.
We did a lot of that. I mean, I did a lot of second unit directing on Les Mis, and one of the days I directed was a riot scene. So again, over 100 extras, 6 cast. We had a Steadicam, a drone, filmed in a square in the centre of Brussels. But get this, okay, we turn up in the square in the morning and not all the cars have been removed, so we had to work around parked cars. Yeah, I mean, that's typical, isn't it? You know, for all the best plans, you turn up, and there are some cars parked right in the middle of where you want your main action to be. So, you know, I flipped the order of the day until we could get those cars moved. And that involved a lot of green screen, where we shot our 100 rioters against green. And then obviously we extended those in the edit to look like 100,000. So there was a lot of crowd multiplication that went on. Both from the aerial shot, I had a guy on top of this, well, it's a bit like the Brussels version of Arc de Triomphe, waving this big red flag, you know. Yeah, it was great though. The actors were really up for it and had a brilliant DOP. Yeah, we got through it.
You definitely did, yeah.
Again, another challenging day for one day shoot. So, you know, even though it's a bigger budget series, you still don't have enough time, you still don't have enough money, so you're always operating within the constraints. But you're always pushing that. You're always pushing the ambition, you know, of what you want to do.
Yeah, definitely. What is kind of your... As somebody who's been in the industry for a lot of years and seen how it's evolved in terms of green screen, VFX, and where you kind of gone from that, what's your perspective on it? Are you... 'cause some people... do seem to want to go back to a more traditional sense, but I do think there's value in kind of merging the two and not going completely, you know, one man in one green room and that's it, but finding a balance between the two. What do you think?
Yeah, no, that's an interesting question, because, I mean, like most people, I love Mission Impossible when Tom Cruise does his own stunts. There's more value in it, isn't there?
Again, there's something that feels...
it's about authenticity.
Mm-hmm.
Because we know he's doing it.
Yes.
I think green screen does still have a place, absolutely, particularly if you're talking about large numbers of crowds, for instance. There's no way that, you know, even on a show like Les Miserables, we could have afforded to have hired 100,000 or even managed 100,000 supporting artists that day. So, yeah, we couldn't have achieved that scene without visual effects. And that would have been a loss to the story. Similarly, you know, on Shetland, the show I've just produced, season 7, we had a super tanker, an oil tanker, in a waterway in Shetland. They call them vows, which a fishing boat is driving towards to explode a bomb that doesn't actually exist on board the little fishing boat. And again, we couldn't have done that on our budget or got a super tanker to park where we wanted it to park so it looked good for the cameras. So we dropped that in post-production. We shot the fishing boat for real, both from the shore and with drone shots over the top of the fishing boat in a nice dynamic way. But again, we couldn't have done that. So I think it's, you know, visual effects are important for two reasons. A, it can tell the story well, and B, cost. You know, because we just couldn't have afforded to have hired a supertanker or put it where we wanted to put it or hired 100,000 extras. So, you know, and the technology is coming on, you know, and the, you know, from when I first did visual effects in any meaningful way, which was in 2005, to now, 17 years later, my goodness me, I sound old. But, you know, the techniques and the resolution are, incredible what we can do now. But there are still some things that are tricky. Still now, for instance, you may have an element, so say it's the tanker, and the interface with the water. Anything that links with water is still very difficult to do because you've got a static object and a moving object next to each other. And still technically, that's a difficult thing to achieve well. As is people walking. They look a bit like robots, unless you're super high-end.
Even then, sometimes you're like...
So roll on the day when we can have a visual effect that can do water well. So there's a challenge. But it is amazing what you can do.
It is amazing. It's terrifying almost. Like the things we had, like last season, we spoke with a VFX supervisor, and the things she told me that, you know, they'd done in these shows, I was like, nothing is real. Nothing is real.
Nothing is real. No, that is, don't believe anything you see. So for instance, I made this film. So I directed a film for the History Channel called What's the Earth Worth? It was great. Honestly, it was a stop take of the planet, basically. And we cut the world's resources down into 10 areas. Water, food, gold, oil, rock, etc., etc. And each category had its own kind of quirky section where I interviewed experts and then we illustrated things using visual effects. So, for instance, we filled a football stadium full of fish. An American football stadium. So we filmed that in a small green screen studio in Glasgow, where we had green steps, green backdrop, and we got a few crates of fish in, and we for real dropped fish down these sets of steps. Then we multiplied that to fill a football stadium through visual effects. So, you know, that's quite cool, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Because there's no way you could do that for real.
No way, yeah. yeah, it's just mental. But that's how it is now. And like even the smallest of movies will have something VFX. Like it's so rare that there'll be, at least if it's high-end, at least if it's like a studio production, it's going to be VFX in there. Even if it's just cables, you know, even if it's just wires in the shot.
Yeah, I mean, we, you know, in Dracula, we had a hand walking across the floor and throttling the captain of the ship. It's brilliant. But obviously on the day, it looks a bit strange, actually, when you're filming it. But the actors do a great job of keeping it real, even though they might have their arm taped with bright green luminous tape. I mean, Dracula was a massive visual effects feast. In episode 2, which I was more involved with, we built an old ship in studio. We filmed it in Bray Studios in Windsor. We had to strike the castle set, get rid of that, and build a ship in 5 weeks. So the art department did an amazing job, and obviously all the construction folk that came in to help us do that. And then for the scenes on board the ship, depending on the time of day, we'd either have green screen, blue screen, or white screen. And so we had to schedule it in a way that we did all the green screen, all the blue screen, all the white screen. But of course, sometimes we had to flip because of an actor's availability or, you know, other scheduling issues. But that was a massive green screen all the way around the edge of studio. You imagine that was a huge thing for us.
And as you know, you're there from the beginning and through it all, you know how the sausage is made. When you see the final cut, are you able to kind of forget what it looked like when you were filming?
Yes and no. I actually quite like remembering, because you then get a sense of achievement that we've pulled it off. You kind of forget the pain quite quickly. Not the pain, but the challenges. You know, I mean, it's a challenging thing. It's a massive problem solving exercise, bringing something like that to life. And yeah, it's great when it goes out. You know, sometimes I watch things that I've made go out, and sometimes not. Sometimes I'm so word perfect that I would just rather go out for a meal or a walk or whatever. But most of the time I watch it go out as a mark of respect, really, to everybody that's worked on it and who is in front of the camera too, cast and crew, because it's a huge team effort and everybody works so hard to get it right, you know.
Yeah. I'm sure you feel this way with, like, most of the things that you do, because, as you said, there's so much hardship put into it, so much passion and effort. But is there any project in particular that when you saw the final cut that just blew you away?
Wow, that's a good question. I did a film once called Stephen Hawking's Brave New World. It was for Channel 4. And it was a really challenging film because it was 5 international locations, 5 different presenters, and 5 pieces of cutting-edge technology. I filmed the Google driverless car, the first television company to do that. And I filmed a wheelchair that was controlled by the power of the mind alone. And I filmed the world's largest optical telescope. So you get the gist. It was incredibly challenging and interesting filmmaking. And I think when all that came together with my amazing crew and my amazing assistant producer, who did the research to make it happen, I was really proud of that one, just because it was tough. But also the stories that were being told were hugely significant for a lot of people. And drama-wise, I think when we called Wrap on season 7 of Shetland, having been filming for so long and working very hard for a long time, I was hugely grateful to everybody who, like me, had kind of gone beyond, above and beyond, because you become a big family, really. That's how it should be. You have to look out for each other. And that was a massive achievement, filming 2 seasons back to back. So for drama, it's not a particular moment of the filming, because there are so many good ones, I can't mention them all on Shetland. But just the fact that we did it, and not just did it, I feel that we excelled at producing really amazing quality material under lockdown and under COVID, with all that extra.
Oh, it's such an accomplishment. It really is, yeah.
I mean, we've got 3 nominations for the Royal Television Society Awards: Best Series, Best Director, Best Camera Craft, for season 6, and also Best Director for Scottish BAFTAs for Max. And that's a real achievement, I think, to have that nomination for a returning series. And it's kind of a, hopefully some recognition that, you know, we did, you know, produce excellence during difficult times. Mm-hmm. I'm super proud of everybody, really chuffed.
For a series that have gone on for so long, to keep the momentum, to keep up the quality, you don't see that often. And you've really done that with Shetland. And I'm sure that you shed a lot of tears and blood and sweat, you know, all of that went in there. What does Shetland mean to you? What was it about it that called to you and that, you know, you stuck on with it?
I when I first learned that the Shetland producer job was kind of going for grabs, I was immediately on the phone to my agent going, please, 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 I've really got to meet the exec. I love that show. I genuinely love the show.
What was it about it? When did you come across it?
Oh, a few years before. I remember watching season 4 and thinking, this is outstanding. I'd love to do this. Because that was just coming out the start of my journey into drama. I thought professionally, oh, it's excellent storytelling, brilliant scripts set in the amazing context of Shetland. And I like a bit of travel with my job, you know, and I like to have those different experiences, both at work and in the little free time that I have, you know, to explore new places and experience different things. But at the heart of it were some brilliant performances, you know, Dougie Henshaw's Perez, Alison O'Donnell's Tosh, you know, an amazing ensemble cast, always an incredible guest cast. And so I just thought that's a quality piece with a big following, you know. So I just thought, yeah, that's what I want to do. So I had an interview with Kate Bartlett, the exec, and very happily she offered me the job, which at that moment was for season 6, because we didn't know that the pandemic was around the corner. And then when the pandemic happened, we very sadly had to suspend production. And that was just after our tech recce, actually. We came back from Shetland. And at that time, I think there were more cases on Shetland than in Glasgow. We had to kind of suspend production. We all thought it would be for a few months and not actually what ended up being a full year before we actually went into principal photography.
Yeah, how was it to return to that? Like, did you still feel connected to the project?
Absolutely. I never let it go from my head. And just the determination to get it made together with the team that stuck with it as well. My HODs, you know, all stuck with it and then were with us last year for all year for season 6 and 7. So it was, yeah, at times a labour of love, but, you know, COVID was the massive factor for us. We had to make sure that when we went to Shetland, we didn't take COVID with us. So we all got tested. We took our own lab to Shetland for all our COVID testing so that we didn't impact on the Shetland community. And we were very careful about the way we conducted ourselves when we were over there. You know, we lived very sheltered lives, put it that way, when we were up there.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, everyone went through that. Yeah, all the stories I'm hearing from filmmakers, it's also changed a lot, you know, even now. We've returned, in a sense, but I think there's always something that lingers.
I didn't want the show to look like it had been made under COVID. That was the priority, both for myself and the director, the execs and so on. It was important that it looked like it was normal. So no masks in camera. We had to develop ways of working. We called them close contact cohorts, where we had certain numbers of actors that could come close to each other and certain ones that couldn't. So that very unfortunately at times affected blocking, but only a minimal amount. So it didn't look like the show was made under COVID. But yeah, that was a whole new level of thinking.
Problem solving, thinking on your feet.
Yeah. Yeah. And one massive impact was we couldn't really share actors across productions very easily, which is a given normally. And that really was hard for us because some of our actors were on other shows and we wanted them, but we couldn't have them and vice versa. There were other shows that wanted our actors. And the only folk losing out really were the actors because they got less work, you know, and I'm all for actors getting as much work as they possibly can. That was hard.
It definitely sounds it. You've had probably tons of experiences from Shetland that you're going to keep on taking with you into your work. Is there any thing in specific from shooting season 6 and 7 that you feel has changed the way you approach producing? Big question.
There was an occasion on Shetland, Block 2, Season 6, where the islands were fog-bound. And we lost a day and a half's filming as a result of that, at a location that we couldn't have at any other time. So we had to rewrite the script. We had to really think on our feet. And what I realised was that you can do that, and you can even sometimes make things better. That it's not the end of the world when the scenes that you felt were so important to the script have to be changed at the last minute. As long as the overall logic is right and the journey for the characters is right and you're hitting the absolutely key story beats. So we had to really rein back those scenes. You know, we really had to compromise our plan, but it was all fine in the end. So always keep positive. I am a bit of a positive person. You know, cup half full, never half empty kind of approach. But yeah, we really had to think then, and we were supported by our brilliant script team back in Glasgow and London who helped us out.
And I think that's a very important takeaway, because especially when you're working on such a big production, there's a lot of at stake, and to keep that mindset to actually pull you through and not get swept up in, a whole day and money and budgeting and all of that. You know, obviously that is a concern, but you just got to move on to the next step.
Absolutely. And we had that, obviously, we had a couple of instances where actors had either been in close contact or had COVID. And again, we then had to reschedule or rewrite scenes. And that story, if you're clever about it, is more robust than you think. I think that's the takeaway. Obviously, so long as those key story beats are met, either in that scene or in other places within the script. So you've got to keep your eye on that. But all is not lost if you have to change a scene at the last minute. Just hopefully don't do it too often.
Yes. Okay. So, I mean, you've had an amazing career, and I'm sure you'll continue to as well. Incredible experiences in all kinds of different places, all kinds of different roles and details and accomplishments. That's just magnificent, and something most people can only ever dream of. But have there ever been moments where you wanted to quit or step back from this industry?
Good question. Not quit. I've never wanted to quit. But I have felt, I think, you know, when we had to be stood down because of COVID time and time and time again on Shetland, which means the production team have to rebook actors, rebook accommodation, we have to reschedule. And that hit us time and time again. And I was just like, we have to keep going, but this is too much. And it's just not normal. We like to have a plan and stick to it and not to continually have the rug pulled from under our feet. And it did get wearing, absolutely. And I know the team felt it, and I was very grateful to all of them for just keeping going time and time again. But I did feel helpless at times, because when it's something like COVID, that's not something that you can control as a producer. And it's the uncontrollables that cause you problems. But no, I've never wanted to quit. I love it too much. It's quite addictive. I mean, I've been in the business over 20 years now, and I just love to tell a good story well, because that's what it boils down to. And I also love working with a team, a small team in documentaries, big team in drama, bringing everybody together for a common purpose is just such a brilliant feeling. And sitting in that final mix, as I was on season 7 with our commissioning editor, Gaynor Holmes, and episode 6 of season 7, she turned to me and she said, "That's the best 1 hour of TV I've seen in a while." Says it all, doesn't it? And but I'm there representing everybody. I was brimming with pride. Because, yeah, we worked really hard for that. But when it's recognised, that's great.
It's catharsis, yeah. Mm-hmm, exactly. And, you know, you start out as a naval officer. There's probably some people out here listening right now who are also in a completely different career, but are looking to get into filmmaking. What advice do you have to those? And what should they expect when they're making this move?
Advice-wise, I mean, it's easy to say don't give up, isn't it? I mean, that's everybody says that. I would say get yourself out to events. Join organisations like Women in Film and Television or Directors UK. Go to conferences like the Sheffield Documentary Festival or the London Film Festival and start networking. It's really hard, I know. But I always find that I'm meeting somebody in person and hearing their passion comes across a lot better than an email out of the blue, where you can't really portray your personality and what makes you want to do the job that you want to do, whether it's first assistant director or directing or producing or hair and makeup. So I think it is about getting out there. I didn't have any family in television. Obviously, my mum was an amateur actress, very good one. But when I first got into the business, I had to ring an exec producer and knock on a door and do things that were a little bit outside my comfort zone, if I'm honest. I was slightly embarrassed, but I was determined at the same time, and charming and smiling and enthusiastic. And eventually I got my break. And then I was all over it and, you know, really took that opportunity really seriously. And if people like you and you work hard and you produce the goods, you will move on. So network, try and meet people in person through that networking, get out to industry events and almost try and be practical. Try and make a short film. Try and, you know, talk to folk. Keep trying. I think try is the operative word. Keep trying and you will get there in the end. You really will. But for those rejections, make sure you have Teflon coating, because it's often not about you. It's about the fact that there are 50 people ahead of you and you were just unlucky that time. But eventually, if you are determined enough, just keep going and you will get there.
Wise words. All right, I think we should pull up into some roundup and some movie and show recommendations. Now, I asked you a little bit before we began this to give me a show or movie that inspired you.
And I just have to choose one, do I?
Yes.
Oh.
I know, it's torture, really, but that's what you, because really that's how you get hard. The one. What's in your head right now?
Okay, the one that's in my head right now is Bad Sisters, because I just watched it on Apple TV and it is brilliant. Loved it. Clever storytelling, entertaining, thrilling, laughing out loud, and also hiding behind a cushion. Loved it. Absolutely loved it. Really recommended it. And it's inspired me, because whenever I see a show made that well, I get really fired up about the business. I go, yes, yes. That's it. And so for me at the moment, it's Bad Sisters. I know it's only just on and you might want me to pluck something from ages ago, but that. There you go. That was hard. I've got, you know, about four or five in my head.
Yeah. I know. Me too. But, you know, you want the one that's on your mind, you know, the one that's just like getting that feeling up in you. Now, what about a movie or show that's your guilty pleasure?
Well, that's easy.
Mm-hmm.
MasterChef. Absolutely love MasterChef. I like the professionals, I like the celebrity, I like the amateurs. Anything with MasterChef, I'm there. It really helps me relax. I love food. I like to cook. What's not to like? It's a great format and it's done brilliantly. So amazing. Yeah, MasterChef. Yes.
Great. There you go. And then finally, what about a movie or a show that you'd love to experience for the first time again?
I was torn between two here, but I've got to pick one, haven't I?
Yeah, I do.
Okay. Squid Game.
Oh.
Yeah. I thought that was brutally clever. And cutting edge different. Just refreshingly different. I know there's a lot of killing in it, but blimey, is it done well. With a really good story. That's it. It's all about the story. Authenticity again. Unbelievably good. Loved it. Absolutely loved it.
It's one that just sits in your bones. It really does.
It stays with you, doesn't it? It's still, I mean, I watched it 6 months ago, whenever it was, and it's still with me now. In fact, maybe it's time for another watch. But I, of course, I know the end now, don't I?
Yeah, so it won't be the same, you know? Yeah, exactly.
That's why it's so pertinent to this question. Uh-huh. Yeah, Squid Game. Yeah, definitely. But don't make the sequel, because it just won't be as good.
It's so difficult, though, isn't it? It really is. And especially, oh, no, that's a whole different conversation. I'm going to stick to the topics here. But it's just, you know, maybe it'll be brilliant. But also, yeah. It's going to be to a completely different audience now that it's blown up, because it wasn't made for that audience, you know? It's a,
sure.
Yeah. It'll be interesting.
I will watch the sequel. So yes, there's a lot definitely. Of folk out there that will watch it. So that's probably why they're making it. So.
Yes, exactly. Now, before you changed careers, while you were still in the Navy, when you'd just gotten out of university, if that version of yourself could see you now and see what you're doing, how do you think she'd react?
I think I'd give myself a pat on the back and go, well done for keeping going. Because, do you know what? Now, a lot of my friends are retiring and I feel that my career's, you know, just starting almost. Or this version of my career. So I've not got any plans to retire yet. I think I've tried to be true to myself and done what I've what I love to do. I think a pat on the back and maybe a little glass of wine to say well done.
Yeah. Sounds about right.
Little glass of red wine, right. You know, mm-hmm. Well done, cheers, that kind of thing. But yeah, I mean, I think I'd be surprised, actually. Mm-hmm. I think I'd go, wow, where did that come from? but then a kind of a pat on the back, well done, you know. Mm-hmm. Because it was always in there. It mm-hmm. just needed a bit of teasing out. Yeah. And I think, you know, I've come the scenic route, haven't I, to this point. And I think that's helped me as a person and as a producer. Because no experience is ever wasted. And that's true for anybody who comes into this industry from different walks of life. Bring that with you, because, you know, filmmaking and television drama is about life.
It is. It's your unique perspective. It's the gathering of all of these unique perspectives that we all have. Definitely. Yep. This has been such an inspirational conversation. Again, it's what you were talking about. It's the buzz, you know, it's the connection. Now, talking about inspiration, I've asked you to give a shout out to a woman in the industry that inspires you.
I'm actually going to continue on the Bad Sisters route. And I'm going to say Sharon Horgan. I mean, I loved her in Catastrophe, but this work, this piece of work, Bad Sisters, is so exceptional. I admire her. I was reading up a little bit about her and she went to university a bit later. She was 27. And so got into the industry a bit like me, a little later in life. And I connect with that. I also love the fact that she, particularly in Bad Sisters, has given a lot of roles to women. You know, it's a very female-centered story and script. And there are so many good female actors out there. I loved that, especially. And I think there's more room in our industry for that kind of story. So, yeah, Sharon, well done. Cheers. Love to meet you one day.
Oh, wouldn't we all? Yeah. So thank you so much for coming on, Louise, and sharing everything, your experience here. It's so insightful. And I hope that people out there listening has been taking notes, as they should. Yeah.
Oh, well, it's my pleasure. I've really enjoyed talking to you, and I just hope that, you know, it has helped and entertained folk out there.
Yes. Do you have anything you want to plug or promote? Upcoming projects?
I'm in prep on the next season of Shetland now. And it's going to be an interesting experience. Be keen to see the Scandi noirness of Shetland and the amazing landscape up there. But at the heart, there'll be, there will be significant differences. And it's a challenge for sure. I'm looking forward to it.
Everybody, stay tuned for Shetland season 8. That's going to be so amazing. Do you have any idea when it's coming out?
Not yet, no.
No.
But
patience.
Patience, indeed.
Mm-hmm. All right, I'll definitely stay tuned, and I'm also going to have to go watch Bad Sisters now because you gave me such a hard sell.
You got it.
I need to.
It's amazing. Yeah. It's insanely good.
All right, thank you so much, and have a great evening.
Thank you.
I'm Lauren, and you're listening to Making It Woman in Film. Yeah.
That was the Disney Channel thing that I just
thank
did
you.
For those who can only hear me.
It is, we could feel it. We could all feel it in spirit. Yes. Thank you. You are Lauren. I'm Evita. And this is your little roundtable. We are here. We are gathered. And on the agenda today are two topics, a quick chat about the Oscar noms, and and then Ginny and Georgia, because it's an interesting and annoying but easy to watch show that I enjoy. And I don't like that I enjoy it, but I do. I think today the Oscar nominations came out for this year. If you guys have been listening to this show or followed us or anything over the past 2 years, you'll know that I don't really care for awards at all, and I've kind of just stopped watching because it's just
accurate.
It's
pretty accurate.
The roots of the issues are not something that can just be easily fixed, and that is clear by the fact that this year no women directors and no women screenwriters have been nominated for any Oscars.
Yeah.
And that is not because they weren't there.
Because they were.
No, they were. It's just the same. I think for the past 2 years there were at least two women directors nominated, which was great, and I was like, wow, finally. Yeah. But then here we go. And it's just are we surprised? No, not really. And it's that way where 2 years ago it would have been outraged more and things like that, but it's just where the Oscars stem from. It's not I've wrote an article on this 2 years ago. I'll link it down below, but it just from the history of the Oscars to the campaigning for Oscars to the award body of the Oscars, the actual people who choose the nominations, it just it's no wonder. It really is no wonder. And so I'm gonna stop wondering, and I personally just I don't know, we should just leave the Oscars behind altogether, and I think that is slowly happening anyway. Who really watches it anymore? It's just...
It is becoming less relevant because it's just...
It is.
It keeps, nominating those, film bro movies.
Artsy-fartsy films.
Exactly. Yeah. I just get disappointed. I've been really disappointed the last couple of years.
Yeah, and it's not to say that the movies nominated weren't good, but a lot of them are just, classic Oscar bait, and it's just tiring, but it's, just don't, I would just encourage you to just, drop the Oscars. Just stop it. Just move on.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's not going to get better, and we should just, move towards creating something better instead.
Yeah.
Of trying to fix something that has existed this way for, almost 100 years.
Yeah.
just, I wouldn't bother. I honestly wouldn't bother being fussed. And it sucks because it is obviously, in the US, the most revered film award, but also generally across the globe, the one film award that the one award everybody knows about is the Oscars, even though it is very limited. Not only like just mainly focused on American movies, but then even within that scope, it's just, there are so many, I'm tired, I don't care. Like, they've tried to checkbox it, but I don't think you can do it.
Yeah.
I don't think that solves the issue of what movies we deem worthy, and also the system of which these movies have to fight to be seen. Because, like, the people nominating these movies, they don't have to watch them all.
Yeah.
You know, like, people are campaigning for these movies specifically to the people who are voting on the Oscars.
Yeah.
Right? And so if you have a shit ton of money to do that,
yeah, like Top Gun,
you're able to send all the letters, you're able to do all the advertising, you're able to put the movie in people's minds.
Yeah.
And also, most people on the body are people who work in the film industry, who know people, who are friends with people. Like, this is not an objective thing. Mm-hmm. It's not. Anything else? Sorry, I'm just... It's just like, I know I just had to bring it up, but it's just that way where I'm like, are we surprised? No. Like, just... Goodbye.
Yeah. I don't know. Like, I just got, like, real tired of it a long time ago. Like, I don't even bother. Like,
no, my exactly.
parents still like the Oscars because of, like, the grandiose thing that it was a long time ago. So it's, like, a big party every year. Not like a big party, but just like my dad's makes like a grazing table. So it's more of like the experience. So like I still like eat that shit up every time. Like I still watch it because I'm just like, oh, how fun, like whatever, you know, just for, I guess, like the time wasting of it. But I stopped like legitimately caring about it because it was just like kind of stupid. And I don't know. I'm kind of over it. Aesthetically, no, because it's fun for me, but like I can't bother.
I'll check out the red carpet, but like it's so difficult with the awards because I think most of these movies do deserve them.
Yeah,
you know, like it's not, but to create a competition out of art as well is just very difficult, I think, especially when you're working with such a huge range. Like maybe if you made it more specific, maybe if you made it genre based instead.
Yeah, that exactly. Could work.
But the thing is, with these movies, again, you look at the things, and most of the time, it's going to be, like, dramas, period pieces. Like, you'll never see a horror movie in there, you know? Like, it's
yeah.
a very specific type of look that they're after. And, yeah. Anyway, I'm like, yeah. Moving on. Ginny and Georgia. did not Ginny get any Oscar Georgia. Awards because it's a TV show. And also it's Ginny and Georgia. So season 2 is out of this show. I'm assuming kind of that everybody kind of is familiar with this premise. It's a single mom with her teenage daughter and young boy who've just moved to a new town. The mom has a criminal background, a little bit shady. She's very charming, very southern. That's Georgia. Surprise. and then you have Ginny. How would you describe Ginny, Lauren?
Twat. Yeah. Like, that's... And I'm not even... Like, that's not even, like, going into the character development that she's had this season, which we'll get to. But, no, she's just a twat. And I'm not even being, like, a teenage nightmare. Like, no, she's just like that. It's not because she's a teenager.
It goes a little bit further than that.
It's
because
she's a nightmare.
It's not, and it doesn't mean, like, I have sympathy for her, yeah. but generally...
It is hard yes. sometimes, though.
It is. It is. And I'm sorry, but, like, it is.
Yeah.
The first season really didn't sit well with me.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not because I thought it was a bad show, but just because it wasn't a show made for me. It was a show made for 15-year-old girls.
Yeah.
Like, very clearly, the language, the dialogue, the plot. It was just very...
I think
extremely cheesy and yeah.
It was like, I think when I watched it, like, I fell in love with Georgia because I honestly really like, I think the highlight of the show for me is Georgia. I love Women in Crime.
Oh, I completely
love her to death. But it was quite the shock when she started going to that new high school and all those children started speaking the way they were speaking. I was like, what am I watching? What am I watching? And I've said this before, it is so weird when teenagers have these weird adult-like lives but are literally 15. And it's super uncomfortable. Like, I know that people just, I never really understood, like, the point of it, because, like, I know, like, some teenagers do, like, certain things and some don't. I was, like, the don't, you know? So, you know, that I'm very biased there. Fucking but, like, nerd. I know, literally, but, like, it still is, like, insanely weird and uncomfortable to watch sometimes, because, like, even though I know there are sexually active teens out there, it's so weird when I'm just, like, trying to watch this for Georgia, and then they're like, I'm 15, and then give someone else a blowjob. Because it's, like, it's just so weird. And it's, like, I have the same issue with, like, Gossip Girl, the same issue with, like, Pretty Little Liars. Like, it's all those teen shows that I can't stand, and I just, like, pretend they're in, like, college or something. But, like, because obviously these are all adults playing 15-year-olds. And, like, it's just so weird when, like, that other friend of theirs or whatever, I forgot her name, but the sister of the love interest, she's like super obnoxious, and I know she has like a very bright personality, but it's just like the way she was talking and the way they all act is super weird, because they all act like they're 30 but then they're like, I'm a freshman, and I'm like, oh my god, no you're not. It was traumatizing to see like the teenage school bits. I hated that.
You know what, the one credit I will give them is, like, compared to Gossip Girl and Little Liars, I think they do look like teenagers.
No, they do look like teenagers, yeah.
They do look like teenagers. And maybe that's why it's even more uncomfortable, because I do think the thing about Gossip Girl for Little Liars is that wasn't solely directed at teenage girls. I think this is very much so. Like, I do think, yes, true, a lot of drugs, a lot of sex, in a way that feels too much, but it's also, like, kind of the thing, like, most 14, 15-year-olds are curious about, not necessarily doing, but thinking about, you know, because it's a new concept.
Yeah.
And I know that this was not a show for me to watch.
Yeah.
But, I do like the Georgia part, and that's the frustrating thing, is that that was really enjoyable, but because it was so, like, they just acted very, just incredibly awkward and immature and cringy. But that's also how 15-year-olds act. That just made me uncomfortable. It was just more, like, the way they talked as well. I was like, this is so cringy. Like, this is...
Yeah.
But
my sister is 15 and my sister is 17. And even though, obviously, they're, like, on TikTok and stuff. Like, it makes me sound so old that I'm like, obviously, they're on TikTok and TikToking and whatever. But, like... Like, they just, like, they're not like that, you know? Like, obviously they use, like, slang, and, like, even I chronically use, like, slay. Like, my life depends on it.
I know.
But I've never in my life acted like those children are in that show.
No, and that is obviously, again, it's not written by teenagers. And that's very clear as well. Like, the language, like, just don't use slang when you're writing teenage characters. No. Because by the time it's filmed, by the time it's been edited, by the time it's been released, that is out, and it sounds weird and cringy and dated because language moves so fast now.
I do wonder,
like, when I'm watching Gilmore Girls, I wonder if people at the time listened to that and thought, that's cringe.
Yeah.
I wonder if they did, and now, because it seems nostalgic, we don't recognize the cringe, but, like, in 10 years, if we rewatch Ginny and Georgia, will we find the references nostalgic instead of cringy?
That's a good because, thing to, like, pin. For 10 years, we can go back to this.
Exactly. In 10 years, you will have to watch Ginny and Georgia again.
Yeah. But, like, again, I was thinking, like, I think a lot of... I can't remember off the top of my head. I know Spider-Man is one of them. Like, the newer bits. I sometimes... Like, the way that they talk is kind of... I've seen, like... They, to me, seemed very normal to me. And even, I think, some slang was in there. And I think it's because they kind of don't overuse it. And they kind of use it ironically, which is kind of how it's actually used. Because, like, when I'm just, like, slice, 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 like, you know what I mean? I'm not, like, you know? But in Ginny, Georgia, they're, like, I don't even know what they say. Just stupid shit. And it's, like, they're, like, dead serious. Like, this is, like, something that they've, like, put on the script. And it's not just, like, you know? Like, it's just, I don't know. It's just not. It's too
forced. It feels
forced.
Like that stuff should be improvised instead.
Exactly.
Like, it just can't, it just can't be scripted. And it just, it sounds wrong. But yeah, I would be curious to see how we'd react to that stuff, like, later. Because I think it is always when you hear, I don't know, there's something weird about things that are happening right now being referenced, like, in stuff you're watching. Like, I think that's the way people feel a lot about COVID and things like that.
Yeah.
It's just, like, it's weird, you know? Like, it's...
Because, like, we use it for, like, we use, like, film and stuff for, like, escapism. I'm not trying to
escape the TikTok. Yeah,
exactly. But
anyway, so beyond that, like, it just felt awkward and cringy. However, I think that might actually have been a good thing, because I think, and I'm not 15 anymore, so I don't know, but I feel like it's something that is closer to that. And I, like, obviously, even though there is sex, drugs, stuff like that, and very serious topics, it doesn't feel as adult as, like, Euphoria. Like, those are very different, like, completely opposite. Because Euphoria, even though it features teens, is not strictly directed towards teens, which is why it makes it even more weird in a way, and it's... Yeah.
Yeah.
But that was the first season. That was our first season, like, impression. Then season two came. I was not going to watch it, but then you were watching it, and I was like, you know what, I'll sit in on this.
I liked season two more. I think it picked up quicker on what was going on in season one. Obviously, like, season ones are usually very, very slow. They're usually not the best of anything. But season two, I think, really kind of, I really liked season two a lot more than season one. I think we got, like, more backstory into Georgia, which I love. Like, I want to know everything about that woman. And it just kind of, like, gave us more. It gave us more to munch on. And Ginny did have a slight character development, because obviously, as I've said before,
redemption.
Yes, she is a fucking bitch. Like, everything about her, she's such a victim, and she has, like, real problems, but she never really addresses those, and then, like, falls victim, and she's depressed for stuff that is, it's very solvable, it's very dumb. Even I have been depressed, you know what I mean? So it's, like, all these real issues, like, and it wasn't even, like, oh, one stems into the other, like, no, she was just being insane, like, insane. And, like, for someone who's, like, constantly so whiny about her horrible life and whatever, she completely neglected Marcus, who was actually going through, like, real depression. So, I don't know. Like, she was just absolutely awful. She's so mean. So mean. Like, obviously, we've all fought with our mother, but I don't think I've been that mean and, like, that weird. Like, I don't know.
Yeah, I think the issue was that she, like, in season one, she was just incredibly whiny and very self-centered. It seemed like she had no patience or empathy for other people, and everything had to surround her. And, like, again, as you said, she did have real issues, but that wasn't the focus. And it seemed, it just seemed off. And she wasn't very empathetic. She was just incredibly annoying and obnoxious, which was in stark contrast to Georgia, who's, like, fascinating, and she's not a good person necessarily.
Yeah.
But she cares, you know, and she was a very complex person, and I feel like they probably wrote her first and was like, okay, we want to show about, like, a mom doing the shit. And then I don't know if this is what happened, but then they were like, okay, now Ginny, you know, like, make it a mother-daughter thing and not just a mother who happens to have children thing, you know, like, it felt, the two storylines, their two storylines felt so opposite.
They're just not compatible.
And that was what felt off, because like, it's supposed to be kind of like a modern Gilmore Girls.
Yeah.
Right? Like, that is what it's supposed to do. And the thing about Gilmore Girls is that the vibes were the exact same for both the mom and the daughter. Like, that was the whole thing, that they got along because they were so close in age, because she had been a teenage mom, because she'd raised her by herself, and they were more like sisters than mother and daughter. But here, it seems like it... Yeah, what I wanted from this was to have, like, a criminal mother-daughter, Gilmore Girls kind of relationship. And it kind of came to that point.
Mm-hmm.
Was kind of a confrontation where Ginny seemed to understand where Georgia was coming from and all of this stuff, which helped their relationship a lot.
A lot.
And there was, I'm not going to spoil it, but there was a huge moment where Ginny finally kind of became part of her mom's life and lifestyle and web of lies. Which to me was the point where I was like, yes, that's it.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't really hold on to that, no. Which I was disappointed by. I hope if they get a season 3 that they will go full in on that, because I think that's the most interesting aspect of it.
Yeah.
And would also take away from this very stereotypical teenage, like, high school theme, which we've seen over and over and over again and isn't really doing anything new. Like, they're not doing anything new. They're doing something new with Georgia. And together, if they bring Ginny into that, like, if they have them parallel in a way, that would work so much better and would be just really good.
Yeah.
Otherwise, they can just get rid of Ginny and it can be that little kid instead. Like, it's just...
Yeah, like, if Ginny dies, I would be so happy. Even with her redemption arc, like, I think, like...
There's just a lot of work to do, because I think they really messed up in the first season.
Yeah.
Because she's just incredibly unlikable. And I'm not saying she has to be a good person, but she's unlikable.
It is.
Like, and she's not empathetic, unlikable. She's not, like...
No. And I think, like...
Provocative.
Yeah.
Like, she's just...
She picks, like, fights. Stop. Yeah, she is... She's just a mean girl. Like, she is just a mean girl. Very unprovoked. Oh, yeah, and a lot of... I have a deep, dark feeling that, like... This knowledge of her mom's secrets, she's gonna use it to get back at her mom. She already has, but I feel like now that she's kind of gained her mom's trust, because even her mom called her untrustworthy. And it's like, has her mom committed crimes? Yes. Does that make her untrustworthy? No. I would trust Georgia with my life. Like,
yes.
But exactly. Ginny, that's no. Ginny point. Is very awful. And I think that, like, just as her mom is starting to trust her, I think it could... They could really do a good job with season 3 where they really solidify that relationship, or they could just keep going as they're kind of going now. And I feel like she's going to use it against her.
I just
her.
Think that would be so boring. Like, it feels like it's just a very dramatic version of what is kind of the typical teenage daughter is angry at her mom because hormones and growth and differences, and you kind of have to rebel a bit, and, like, that's fair. It was, like, one very typical teenage, like, life, and then a very cool and fucking fascinating criminal mom's life. It just, like, was very lackluster and just felt completely off. But they need to, like, commit to a genre.
Yeah.
I think. And I think they just need to move fully into the crime aspect. They can still have it be, like, soapy.
Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah.
But make the issues much more, captivating.
Yeah, exactly.
Right? Like, it's just...
A lot of the plot right now is, like, 45% Georgia's incredibly interesting situation, and then literally just teenage drama. Like, there was so much time spent on Ginny's relationship with Marcus. Like, it was just insane. And she also just has, like, such a big ego as well. She thinks she's... She really thinks she's doing something, and it's just not... clever. Like, what they're doing with her isn't what they think they're doing. They're doing great with Georgia, but somehow they just cannot. I don't know if it's, like, satire or on purpose,
but it is a great idea to have this kind of mother-daughter criminal relationship, because it's incredibly complex, the things that George has done for her as well. And I think what needs to happen is that Ginny needs to, like,
die.
Fuck up. Like, no.
I just hate her. Kill somebody.
Oh, Ginny needs to kill somebody, and Georgia has to cover up for her, or something like that.
Where they're kind of even in a way. And they will be
truly bonded, or something like that. Like, mm-hmm. Oh, that would be great. Yeah, Ginny has to kill somebody now.
I thought that, like, that was something that was going to happen in season two, because there were a lot of moments where she kind of fucked up, and I was like, oh, like, is something bad gonna happen? Like, I was maybe not, like, kill somebody, but I thought maybe Ginny would eventually commit a crime and Georgia would cover it up. I think she has to do something severe
mm-hmm. and Georgia has to help her. Like, that is the only fixable thing here, because otherwise they're just going to be stuck in this
horrible circle loop.
Yeah.
And I just think, like, she needs to be held liable for a crime, not, like, legally, but liable for a crime, so that she doesn't hold all of it against her mother. Because a lot, obviously in season one, she discovers a secret of her mother's. Oh, I don't think it's a secret. I mean, season one, she killed, Georgia killed, like, her, one of her husbands, and Ginny found out about it because of a detective trying to, sorry, I'm just giving them, like, the back, because of a detective who's, like, been hired or whatever. And I just thought it was really interesting that she found out through the detective, not through Georgia, really. And she blames it all on Georgia. The entire, like, first three episodes of season two is Ginny just, like, blaming her mom for this massive weight on her shoulders. But it wasn't really her. Like, the detective told her, and then it was just kind of like a moment of confrontation where it was basically confirmed. But, like, she knew. So it's just, it's really strange to me, like, what they're actually doing with her. And I don't know, they're gonna have to really, like, I guess maybe now that Georgia's, I don't know, I just don't know.
I think it's hurting the show and its potential that they keep giving Ginny, like, these cheesy
mm-hmm.
storylines. Like, it's, I think it is hurting it, because it does feel like it's maybe 60% on Ginny and 40% on Georgia.
Yeah, but it should be, like, it needs 80%.
I just think if they come into the same timeline instead, it will just do wonders for it, and it could actually be really, really interesting. But right now it just feels very discombobulated. Like, it feels like they're trying to do two different shows at the same time, and only one of them is good. Because I do think, like, even, yeah, like, I think there'd be something very, like, fucked up and interesting about Georgia now having this thing over Ginny.
Yeah,
which exactly. Is, and, like, is their bond really love, or is it, like, this, like, knowing that they can't, like, if one person says one thing, the other person says the other thing. Like, that's not good, but it's fun. Like, that is interesting, and that's what you want from TV, that's what you want from fiction, is, like, thought-provoking relationships like that. And right now, it's not thought-provoking. It's like, okay, Georgia clearly has sacrificed and done so much for Ginny, and Ginny is just being incredibly ungrateful.
Yeah.
Like, that is a... And yep. And it's just... Yeah, I want some more meat to the story. I want them to treat Ginny the way they're... I want them to write Ginny with the same interest as they're writing Georgia, because I don't think they are. I don't think they are as committed to her story and to her development as they are Georgia. It's, like, so clear when you're watching it that it just...
Their priority
It feels
is.
Ridiculous when you switch. Yeah. Like, the priorities, mm-hmm. it just feels
because
so
they
silly.
They don't give Georgia that much screen time. However, I feel like they put the most effort into her character, which makes absolutely no sense, because you get, like, 10 minutes, not even 10, like, 5 minutes of quality time with Georgia, and then the rest of it is just Ginny, you know, fucking whatever, doing whatever the hell she's doing, I guess.
Yeah, and it's also, and, like, stuff, a shame, like, because, like, they are working with really serious topics, mm-hmm. like depression and self-harm.
Exactly, and this shouldn't be
but they're
so
not,
ridiculous
and, like, it
to
feels
watch.
Like it's such a... yeah, exactly. It just feels, like, why are they doing this?
Let,
like,
me tell
why
you
are they
something.
Doing such a disservice?
In Puss in Boots 2, which I loved, they did a better, like, depiction of an asthma attack. Not an asthma attack, I'm stupid. Of a panic attack than I've ever seen. And I feel like the portrayal of the cat's mental illness for like 20 minutes was way better than the entirety of Ginny's mental illness. And like, obviously, I feel like a lot of parents are like, you know, quote unquote mental illness, you know, and obviously, as you know, obviously it's like a real thing. Like, it sounds like I'm saying it's not, but I'm definitely like, if I was Ginny's mom, I would be like, shut up, like, you're fine. Like, I would literally just be like, you're fine, shut up. Because like, obviously, like, I don't know, like, it's just, the depiction of mental illness is ridiculous. I sympathize more with Marcus, who is just depressed. He doesn't have exactly a lot of issues. Yeah.
It feels ridiculous, which is such a shame and such a disservice to her character and to the topic. And it feels very first draft to me. It feels like something you would read on Wattpad, where it just feels very like... When you compare the complexity of George's issues to the complexity of Ginny's issues, you're working with an ocean and like a little puddle. Like, it's just...
It's so pathetic.
Surface level. And I want them to, if they go the direction I want them to, I think they could add another layer to it and just do something more, because they're not doing enough. And it's like a 4 out of 10 for me.
Hmm. Yeah.
That's my final words.
Yeah, I agree.
Do you have any final words?
Yeah, I hate Ginny.
I know.
It's like almost violent. Like, I mean, it is. It's violent.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Making It Women in Film, a podcast produced by Bonnie and Brawl and LS Films. If you want to support this podcast, you can do so by subscribing to us wherever you're listening and leave a review or a rating. It'll only take you a few clicks, but it'll mean the world to us. You can also check out our website, womeninfilm.co.uk, follow us on LinkedIn and Instagram at Making Women in Film, and feel free to shoot us an email at makingwomeninfilm@gmail.com if you have any questions or inquiries or anything at all, and we'll try to get back to you. Alright, guess I'll just see you next week. Bye.